Hello, I'm Richard Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi. We're getting smarter, faster, together with new nonfiction books full of original, memorable insights, or OMI, as we like to call them, from the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode...
Hi, I'm Katie Mack, author of The End of Everything, Astrophysically Speaking, and this is my OMI for Bookomi. For me, it makes me think that it's more important than I thought of it before to find meaning in life as it is now and to find meaning in our existence while we have it, rather than trying to let it be posthumously justified in some sense.
The cosmologist and science writer looking forward to the end of the universe, how, when, and why everything we know will cease to be. Katie Mack, welcome to Bookomi.
Thanks for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, before we get to the end of everything, can we go to the beginning of the universe? When did it happen? And what does that tell us about where we're heading in the future?
Well, we have a pretty good idea of when it happened, and we know quite a lot about what went on in the very beginning. So it was about 13.8 billion years ago. And what we know is that in the early universe, the very beginning, it was hot and dense and full of this kind of roiling plasma. And the reason we know that is we can actually see it pretty directly. It turns out that when we look out into the cosmos, the farther away we look, the farther back in time we're looking. And when we look at the farthest stuff we can see, what we see is this background light, this sort of leftover afterglow of the Big Bang. And what's really happening there is that we're seeing parts of the universe that are so far away that they are still, from our perspective, in that early universe, hot, dense phase. So we can see the actual beginning of the universe, and we can see the evolution of the cosmos over time by looking at very distant objects. And that allows us to get a really good picture of what the universe has been doing all this time, and it allows us to think about what the universe might do in the future. And so we can get a really clear cosmic timeline and then extrapolate from there to figure out what's going to happen next.
And where are we on that cosmic timeline? Are we relatively towards the end of it, or are we bang smack in the middle, or what?
Well, I would say the universe is sort of middle-aged. We're fairly far into the process of the construction phase of the cosmos, I guess you would say. If you look at how stars have been forming over time in the universe, the burst of star formation, the most star formation happened many billions of years ago, and it's been sort of slowing down since then. So maybe like 9 billion years ago or so was the peak of star formation, pretty early on in the history of the cosmos. And it's been slowing down. And right now, we can actually calculate that of all the stars that have ever formed and all the stars that ever will form, something like 90% of them have already been made. So from now until the end of the universe, whenever that happens, there's only about maybe 5 or 10% of all the stars ever being formed in the future.
So it sounds like, yeah, most of the work has been done.
Pretty
as long
much.
As the property developers don't pull out at the last minute. and that's all the way through reading your book, which I really enjoyed. Thank you for writing it. Back to this question, I imagine you looking through this great cosmic telescope. I know that, you know, surrounded by equations and maths and formula and principles of physics and astrophysics. But I can't help thinking that why doesn't the telescope go back beyond the beginning of the formation of the universe? What is at the edge of it? What was just before the formation of the universe? Or is that just impossible to know?
Well, you know, there are certainly theories of the cosmos that involve a phase before what we think of as the Big Bang. So there are possibilities where the universe could be going through cycles where there was a previous phase, and then that phase ended either through the collapse of the universe or some other end. And then that led to the Big Bang that we know of as the beginning of our universe. But those theories so far are still fairly speculative. And unfortunately, we really can't see beyond the beginning from where we are, because if we look far enough away to look at the very early universe, looking farther away than that would involve light that has been traveling for longer than the universe has been around. And so it couldn't possibly have reached us by now. Whether or not there was something before that sort of depends on how you define the beginning, but it also would involve going before this hot, dense phase where that we kind of couldn't see through that, even if there were something before that, because what we see in that hot, dense phase is we just see this sort of wall of fire around us. And you kind of can't see through that with light. We're hoping to see through that a little bit to the phase before the fireball, which we think there was a very brief period before this sort of fiery early primordial soup, when there might have been this very, very rapid expansion called inflation that was just the first tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of a second. So we're trying to see through that with gravitational waves, which are these just ripples in the fabric of space itself. And so far, we haven't found solid evidence for that signal, which would tell us about, you know, the earliest moments possible. But before that, if there was a before that, we just don't have tools for that. We don't know if there was anything before that. And so all we can really do is look at theoretical arguments and say, well, you know, if we look at the evolution of the cosmos, if we look at this sort of mathematical theory for how physics works, that would imply that maybe there was something before that. And then we can explore those ideas in theory, and we can even look for, you know, subtle clues and hints in what we see in the early universe that might imply an early phase or pre-universe phase. But at the moment, we don't have any really solid evidence of that.
And even using the term before that or earlier than that, we're applying notions of time, and we're using our own instruments, aren't we, in terms of our biological instruments, to including our brain, to perceive and understand something that might just be beyond our comprehension. And the whole notion of time itself is a way that we use to construct a journey from the beginning to now to the end.
Yeah, I mean, there's a question of whether time could have existed in the sense that we think of it before the beginning, if the beginning involved, you know, a singularity, which some people suspect, where there may have been this phase of infinite density of space-time in the very first moment, then time would have begun at that time, at that event, and there wouldn't have been time before that. So any sense of before doesn't really make sense in that notion, you know, in that idea. But there are a number of possibilities that we discuss in physics all the time that involve our universe kind of coming out of a previous universe, or even coming out of a sort of more eternal phase or eternal space, and our universe is just one of many that branch off in this this much, much larger space that's constantly sort of producing new universes.
I love your job is brilliant, because you get to have conversations all day from the morning to the evening that most people have over a few whiskeys at midnight.
Yeah, it is nice to be able to really ponder the big questions, though, you know, most of my conversations are much more involved in trying to fix bugs in my code or trying to find references, or, you know, much more mundane aspects of these questions.
I believe you. But reading your book helped me to get things into some form of cosmic perspective. And as a human being, the experience is, as you put it, both terrifying and hopeful. What good can ever come of contemplating the ultimate destruction of the universe? Why do it?
Well, I think that it is a matter of perspective. I think that there are a few things. One is that just we are curious, you know, as human beings, as thinking creatures, we want to understand the universe around us. We want to understand where we came from and where we're going. And those are just big fundamental questions that we have that we as people want to know. So there's that fundamental urge we have that we, you know, we indulge in, because that makes us happy and fulfilled as people. But I also think it is a possible, you know, valuable perspective to be able to step away from our daily lives and really think about this much, much longer term, much, much bigger picture, and where we fit into that, and how we can use that to, you know, kind of see a different sort of meaning and purpose in our lives, something that's beyond just, you know, sort of everyday survival, but we're part of this much bigger picture. We are here together in this temporary existence, and we should make the most of that. I think that can be a very helpful way to look at the world sometimes.
Yeah, and one of the ways we find meaning, I totally agree. I mean, it helps to put us in perspective and in relation to fellow man, past, present, and future, doesn't it? But one of the way human beings in the past have tried to cheat time in a way, is to erect monuments to their work and their imagination for the future, cathedral thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But with the acceleration of technology and machine thinking, do you think future generations, future millennia, will even know or care what preoccupied us today? That's what I find a little bit depressing, is we're searching for meaning, and yet however hard we try with our Hadron Colliders and our intense interest in dark matter, in the future, in the relatively near future, people won't care what we're doing.
Yeah, this is something that that Martin Rees brought up when I was speaking with him about the end of the universe, when I was interviewing him for my book. And we discussed this a bit in the epilogue, this question of what kind of legacy do we really have as people right now, if the, as you say, you know, technology increases and maybe people won't be interested in what we're interested in and won't care about the things that we care about. That does, I don't know why we get so invested in that idea, but it is something that I think fundamentally troubles us, the idea that we might be forgotten or neglected, or, you know, cast aside as, oh, that's just part of history, we don't care. And that's something that I really wrestled with thinking about when writing the book, is this question of, you know, not just will people stop caring about us in the future, but will there come a time in the distant future when our past existence no longer matters in any sense, because the universe will be so changed, because you know, everything that we've ever done will be sort of erased by cosmology. You know, how do you come to terms with that? Does that change how you think of the purpose of existence? Does it change how you make moral choices if those choices will be forgotten, if they will not have mattered at some point in the future? And that is a heavy thing to wrestle with. And I'm not sure I've entirely come to a conclusion about the best way to think about that. But I do think that for me, it makes me think that it's more important than, you know, than I thought of it before, to find meaning in life as it is now, and to find meaning in our existence while we have it, rather than trying to let it be, you know, posthumously justified in some sense.
That feeling of temporariness, of being a speck of dust in the universe, it can be both daunting, can't it? But it can be liberating as well, because you think, well, hey, we might as well get on with it and have fun while we're here.
we can't mess things up too much, you know. That's nice. The universe will go on without us no matter how much trouble we cause.
That's an interesting point, yeah, because I wanted to ask you about that. We haven't talked really about our own collective effect on the cosmos, because obviously we're lucky if we think about the planet, let alone the cosmos, in terms of our day-to-day lives and the way we behave as communities and cultures and countries. What about our own effect on the cosmos? Does it really matter to the rest of the universe if we mess things up and destroy the planet with pollution, with wars, pandemics? Does the rest of the cosmos just carry on?
I suppose it does. I mean, There's really no sense in which we are cosmically significant. I hate to say it, but even the kind of matter we are is barely important. So in the universe is full of basically the three main components are dark matter, dark energy, and regular matter. And dark energy is something mysterious that makes the universe expand faster. We don't know what it is, but if we sort of count up its impact on the cosmos, we know that it's about 70-ish% of what's out there. And then there's dark matter, which is a kind of invisible matter that kind of holds galaxies together and is most of the matter in the universe. It's like 80 or 85% of the matter in the universe. It's what all of cosmic structure is kind of built upon, and between dark matter and dark energy, they govern, you know, they really determine the evolution of the universe. Dark matter is something like 25% of the universe. And so the stuff that we're made of, regular matter, atoms and molecules and all of that, that's about 5% of what the universe is made of. So we are very insignificant. Even the kind of matter we are barely impacts the evolution of the cosmos. And then, you know, we are just one species on one planet in one galaxy, you know, like our impact is so tiny. And, you know, I think that it is interesting how much we are able to understand, and, you know, the breadth of our knowledge given our insignificance is quite amazing. You know, how much we can see, how much we can discover is astonishing, truly. But in terms of impact, you know, we we barely touch our solar system, much less our galaxy, much less the universe.
I suppose the heartening thing is that even though our matter doesn't matter, that mm-hmm. at least we care about if it matters or not. That's yeah. our greatest achievement.
Yeah, yeah. I think how much we care, how much we can understand, how our curiosity, those things are truly powerful, I think, to me.
You talk a lot about science fiction in the book, affectionately, as though it's sort of a simple, entertaining child of the grown-up theories. What about space colonization, though? You mentioned Freeman Dyson and his ideas for creating atmospheres under a dome. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you can see, not in our lifetime or the next generation?
I think that it sort of follows from human nature that we want to move out into the cosmos and explore other worlds in person to some degree. I think that's an urge that we have as people, and I imagine that we will continue that kind of exploration and not just for the scientific, gain of studying other places, but also because we want to go and walk around on Mars. You know, I think that's just part of human nature, is that kind of urge to reach out and to wander around whatever our environment is, that even as our environment is expanding through our knowledge of the cosmos. I don't know how easy it will be to ever live in another place. I think that people often underestimate the challenges of living on a place like Mars, where not only do you not have a breathable atmosphere, you also don't have a global magnetic field to protect you from, dangerous cosmic radiation and so on. And I think that it's, Mars is much less habitable than literally anywhere on the planet Earth. And there's very little that could happen to Earth that would make Earth less hospitable than a place like Mars. And so, it is a really massive challenge to find a way to live in these different places. But I also think, as technology improves, it is possible that we will have some outposts on other worlds. And I look forward to seeing how that develops.
It's like we're trashing our own room, so we want to go and find some other new rooms to trash.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I think that when people talk about Mars or other places as these kind of a second home that you need as a backup planet, I think that people do really underestimate how hard it would be, and even if we had a combination of catastrophic climate change and nuclear war and, reasonably sized asteroids hitting the Earth, we could still live more easily underground on this planet than in a place like Mars. It's still, you would have to do a lot to the Earth to make it harder to live on than a planet like Mars. So I think that, we need to be aware of those challenges. And also, when people talk about places as a backup planet, there's this inherent assumption that just having a few people makes it good enough, but you can't really get a large number of humans off of the Earth into another place in any foreseeable way. I mean, there are billions of people on this world, and we're never going to be able to really evacuate in any meaningful sense. And so it will always be a niche thing, I think.
Well, we actually spoke to Freeman Dyson's son, George, the other day on the Bukomi podcast, as you do. Have you met him? Mm-hmm. Do you know
I
George?
Have, yes. Yes, he's fascinating.
He's lovely, isn't he?
Yeah. He's wonderful.
And are you familiar with his work on Darwin and machines and his approach and his latest book, Analogia?
I haven't read his latest thing, no.
Well, I won't talk about someone else's book while I'm talking to you about your book. That would be rude. But as an astrophysicist, mm-hmm. what do you think the origin of our species tells us about where we will evolve in the future?
Well, I haven't thought about that so much. I think that what I think about a lot in terms of the origin of our species and the origin of life on this planet is how we are getting to the point where it really appears that we have enough understanding of the origin of biological life to be reasonably sure that it probably happens elsewhere too. And when I think about the origin of life on Earth, I think that the conditions that occurred here are very likely to have happened many, 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 many other places in the galaxy, either on planets around other stars or even possibly on the moons of the gas giants here in our outer solar system, the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. So, I think that it's very possible and I think probable that there is life out there in the universe in addition to ours, whether or not it's intelligent life, whether or not it's technological, we don't know. And that gets into other questions about how often these things arise. But, you know, I do think that it's unlikely that we're unique in the cosmos. As for what our origins and evolution say about where we're going next, that I don't know. You know, that I think is a much bigger open question.
And I know that, you know, I know that you enjoy science fiction, and I know that you enjoy writing and creating around your science, but does it amuse you, or does it excite you when you hear people talking about visitations from other life forms in the universe? Is it something that you take seriously when, you know, being contacted from other galaxies, or is it something you just dismiss because there's no scientific evidence?
I would say that I think it's extremely unlikely that that alien beings have been contacting or interacting with humans without the scientific community noticing. You know, we in astronomy, we are very invested in finding life on other worlds, and we are doing very thorough searches for all of the signs that we can think of, and we have not yet seen anything. So I think it would be quite strange for something to come here and evade every detection mechanism we have, only to bother a few people in a way that doesn't leave any solid evidence. I think that would be very, very strange. So my sort of bias there, I suppose, based on, you know, experience and my understanding of the science, would be that it's very, it would take quite a lot to convince me that ever happened to anybody. I wouldn't rule it out as completely impossible. I would say that, that I'm not an expert in the kinds of things you need to be an expert in to necessarily, you know, evaluate those kinds of claims.
And do you think, we talked about progress and where we are on the timeline, mm-hmm. and you refer in the book to some of the big experiments taking place around the world as relatively banging blocks together when it comes to the complexity of the universe. Do you think, therefore, that we'll discover, there's plenty left to discover, or are we at that strange sort of narcissistic time where you think that your own generation or your own time has reached some sort of zenith of knowledge? Do you think that we've got a lot to learn about the universe still?
We have so much to learn still, I think. We are at a very strange place with science right now, with physics and cosmology. In both particle physics and cosmology, we are at a place where we have good working theories, good working models of how physics and cosmology work, where we are failing to find counterexamples in our experiments. We're failing to find data in our experiments that disagree with these models that we've constructed, these mathematical models of how the universe works. And that sounds like a good thing. That sounds like we should pat ourselves on the back and be pleased with our progress. But we also know that these mathematical models we have for these different areas of physics don't agree with each other and don't include the most important things in the universe, dark matter and dark energy. So we're at this strange place where we know there must be something missing in our models of the universe. And I keep saying models. What I mean is a mathematical model of how physics works in a certain context. Those are the tools that we have as theorists. We build a mathematical model. We use data to check that model. We refine that model to meet new data that we find, and we, you know, carry on like that. And we refine the models by getting new data that disagrees with the previous model in some way. Usually the way that works is that we have a model that works in almost every situation. Then we look at a really extreme case. The model doesn't fit in that case. And then we refine the model so it fits in every case that we've ever tested. So unfortunately, right now, we have models that fit in every case we've ever tested, but we know from a fundamental physics point of view, they do not agree with each other, and they don't explain these phenomena in the cosmos, dark matter and dark energy. So we're at a difficult point where we need more data. We need to find the extreme conditions where these models break, but we don't have currently the technology to necessarily get to those places where the models break. It's possible that the models break at conditions so extreme that we cannot produce them with our current technology. So that leaves us with a couple of options. We can try and improve our technology, you know, build larger colliders, build better telescopes, and we're working on those things. But also another possibility is maybe by being creative with how we examine the data, maybe by looking at different kinds of conditions in the universe and looking for very subtle clues that we've overlooked before. Maybe we'll see something that points to a new direction for our theories. But right now, it's very strange and frustrating to be apparently getting everything right while knowing we are wrong.
I should think that's a philosophically very interesting place to be, though, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's astonishing because, you know, every time there's a new result comes out says, well, we've confirmed general relativity again, all of us are kind of like, oh, you know, like, that seems like it should be a good thing, but it really isn't.
Yes, I had that experience reading your book. I kept thinking, well, I get that, I just understand that. And then the next page you go, and this, of course, has been disproved. I was like, oh, no.
Anyway,
Katie, thanks for sharing your OMI with Bukomi today.
Thank you. It's been a great chat. I've really enjoyed these questions.
Katie Mack's book, The End of Everything, Astrophysically Speaking, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, before anyone else, sign up to our monthly most wanted email at bukomi.com. Our club and company partners can co-host podcasts with us and connect to the authors on our most wanted lists. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bukomi pod, please let us know by following or subscribing on Apple, Spotify and Google audio platforms. I'm Rich Kilgareth. Stay safe in the knowledge that although one day all this will end, we're only just beginning to understand why we're here. Bye for now.